Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, July 18th. I'm Ray Graff. 2 days before the 50th anniversary of man walking on the moon, we have two astronomers in the studio to answer your questions. Show favorite Bob Berman is joined by Valerie Rapson of the Dudley Observatory at MySci in Schenectady. If you have an astronomy question, we have twice the fun for you today. Give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But the number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Astronomers Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson, and your space calls coming up on Vox Pop after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Well, you know, you put one astronomer on the show, and it's excellent. Now we'll try two. It'll be twice as good. Our first astronomer, well, you know him as one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the whole wide world. Bob Berman is back. He is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Joining us for the first time on this show is Dr. Valerie Rapson. She is the chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory, located in MySci in Schenectady, New York. She earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical science and technology at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Her dissertation focused on the chemical composition and structure of planet-forming disks around nearby young stars. If you have a question about astronomy today, 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, though, the number is 800-348-2551. Bob and Valerie, welcome to the show.
No, thank you.
Yes, thank you. This is great.
First time on the program, Valerie.
Yes, it is.
Tell us about what you do over at Dudley.
Yeah, so as the chief astronomer, I design and run astronomy education programs for people of all ages. So we work with children and adults. We let them look through telescopes. We have a planetarium, a Challenger Learning Center. It's really a great astronomy experience.
There's never any change in the level of wonder I think kids have when you open the heavens to them.
Agreed. They're always fascinated. Whether you're showing them the moon for the 100th time or something brand new, they're always excited.
Well, this is a fun show. I don't know. I suspect you may have heard one or two, but we will chat a little bit and then we'll take calls. And you never know where we'll go. So we'll find out. The number is 800-348-2551. Bob, I was mentioning before the show started, 50th anniversary of the first landing on the moon coming up in a couple of days. You said, I have interesting stories to tell. You talked to Buzz Aldrin at one point.
Yeah, spent an hour with him and with some other astronomers. I think my fourth or fifth book was called Shooting for the Moon. And it was the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 11 at that time. I don't think the book sold very well, to tell you the truth. But I had to write it, so I did a lot of interviews, and I learned some amazing stuff. And when I'm seeing these shows now at the 50th on TV and the documentaries, and we're hearing pretty much the same things repeated, and they're marvelous things because it's a major anniversary. But, yeah, there's a few things I can add to that are little known and for some reason have not really reached the public yet.
Oh, do tell.
Okay. Starting with how Neil Armstrong landed it, because he was at the controls. When he was landing the LEM, he was supposed to bring it down to within 3 or 4 feet of the surface, upon which there were probes attached to 3 of the 4 landing legs of the LEM. And when the probe made contact, a bright blue light would come on the panel. And as soon as he saw that, he was supposed to turn off the engines, kill them entirely, and let it fall the remaining few feet. The LEM was designed so that if it fell that distance, the honeycomb aluminum legs would compress just enough so that the ladder outside the LEM would be the perfect distance for them to walk down.
Right.
Well, turned out he was too good a pilot. He could not bring himself to just shut the engines off and let the thing go bam onto the surface. He flew it softly onto the surface. He was that good. But because of that, he actually blew the landing in that sense, in that the legs did not compress, the ladder was nowhere near the surface, and when Neil Armstrong later went down to the surface and later Buzz Aldrin, they had to jump down quite a distance because the ladder was nowhere near the ground. And when Buzz Aldrin jumped down, here's what's really almost unknown, the urine bag in his boot broke.
Okay, why would you put a urine bag in a boot because that you're walking on?
It's got to be somewhere. Where would you prefer it?
But your hip or something. I mean, on the you're walking on the boot.
Listen, I had nothing to do with the design here. Right. It was on the side of the boot. You weren't actually walking on
okay.
it. Okay. It did break it, and he was too much of a showman, too much of a professional to say something. He never said, oh, no. So nobody ever knew back in Mission Control. But his entire experience on the surface really was more like one small squish for a man.
Well, that's very funny.
Yeah.
You know, we put 12 people on the moon, and I'll throw this out to Dr. Rapson. What did we learn? I mean, it cost a lot of money. It was a great achievement, arguably one of the greatest achievements of the 20th century. What new stuff did we learn?
Right. Well, we've explored the moon with a lot of different things, with satellites, with robotics since then. And it's really something different to put a human being on the moon who can actually touch and feel and really experience what it's like from being there. So we've brought back a lot of moon rocks and moon dust. We've learned the age of the moon and the fact that it likely came from the Earth from an early on collision. So we've had those samples and we've been able to bring them back to Earth and really study those. I think those are some of the best things that we have brought back and learned.
You know, Bob and I have talked often about the composition of the moon on this program, and it's something of an enigma, right? It looks like it's the same stuff as Earth, but there's a twist, right, Bob?
Yes, there's something really weird that still puzzles people, and those who are researching the moon are still, it drives people to drink. Because, yes, obviously a Mars-sized body collided with Earth. We even have a name for it, Theia, that smashed into Earth, and it was the combination of Theia material and earthly material that got flung up into space, red-hot, molten, coalesced to form the moon. This explains why the moon is the only major satellite in the solar system that doesn't circle its parent planet's equator. The moon doesn't go around our equator. The Jupiter moons do. That's why they can line up the way they do through small telescopes. The Saturn moons go around in that same ring plane of the equator, not Earth's moon. Our moon goes around us in the same plane as the solar system, the ecliptic plane. Why? Well, that can be explained by this impact hypothesis. There's only one thing wrong. When we analyze the rocks from the moon, the 832 pounds of rocks that we brought back and the little bit of rocks that the Russians robotically brought back, we find something that's really, really weird. But to understand it, you've got to know about the isotopes of oxygen. So forgive me. Give me 30 seconds more and I'll explain
this. All
right, fair enough. We're all breathing in air right now that's about 20-21% oxygen, right? But oxygen, most oxygen is called O16 because it's got 8 neutrons and 8 protons. They add up to 16 nucleons. However, 1 in 500 oxygen atoms that we're breathing in has an extra neutron. So that's O17. It's got one extra neutron. And 1 out of 2,000 of the oxygen atoms we're breathing in at this moment has 2 extra neutrons, and that's O18. Well, the ratio, remember I said 1 out of 500, 1 out of 2,000, this is holds true for everything on Earth. The oxygen in water, the oxygen in silicon and sand and silica, everywhere on Earth. And that's how we know when we have a meteorite in hand, that's how we know where it came from. Because in other places, asteroids and on Mars and other places, there's a different oxygen isotopic ratio than on Earth. With that as background, when we went to the moon, we found that the moon's oxygen isotopic ratio is the same as Earth, to within one part in 50,000. But how could it be the same if the moon is made up of us plus Theia contents? That was an alien body. How can it possibly be made up of the exact same isotopic oxygen ratio that we have on Earth? And it drives me crazy. It's driving everyone crazy. And that's one reason to maybe go back to the moon, because it shows we don't know everything yet.
Well, Dr. Valerie Rapson, is it driving you crazy?
I guess a little bit. I haven't put too much thought into the moon. I think we'll have some great results coming up in a few years, though. I hear we're going back.
Okay, let's take a call or two before the first break. Number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Herb in Saugerties. Herb, you're first.
Hey, thanks. I'm just curious how the transit of Venus can be used to figure out how far the Earth is from the sun. I guess that was a a methodology used hundreds of years ago. I still don't quite understand how that worked.
Okay. Who wants?
Okay. Well, when we're first figuring out the scale of the solar system, Kepler was able to tell us very nicely the relative scale of things, because using Kepler's laws, we could tell that if Venus is a certain distance and Mars is a certain distance, Venus had to be 4/10 of the Earth's distance from the, I'm sorry, 7/10, Mercury is 4/10. The Earth has to be where it is. We call it 1, Mars is 1.52, et cetera. Jupiter is 5.2 times the Earth distance. And so we knew this for centuries, but it doesn't tell us the absolute size of the solar system. To do that, we need one solid fact. We have to know the distance to the sun, or the distance to Venus, or the distance to something for sure. The transit of Venus would let us do that, because if you observe the transit from different sides of Earth, you can use trigonometric parallax and see that at one location, let's say in Australia, the Venus is just touching the edge of the sun, but it's not for an observer on the other side of Earth.
So, and when did they do that?
They did this in the 18th century, and then in the 19th century, Captain Cook did it in Tahiti. There were transit of Venus, because they're so rare, they happen only 8 years apart. Then you have to wait 105 years or 121 years, it alternates, for the next set of transits that are just 8 years apart. So we just had one, actually, in 2004 and 2008, on June 6th and on June 8th of those years, respectively. But once you do that, by observation, you can actually nail down the distance to Venus and therefore the real distances of the solar system and the real distance to the sun, which is the astronomical unit, which used to be the holy grail in all of astronomy. Now maybe it's the Hubble constant, but back then it was the astronomical unit. And so, yeah, it was a big deal.
We'll take a break here. 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Number is 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today on the program. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson are here to answer your questions. And Valerie, you did your dissertation on chemical composition and structure of planet-forming disks around nearby young stars. What's the nearest young star that has one of these planetary disks?
Yeah, so that was actually one of the stars we studied. It's called TW Hydra, and it's only a couple hundred light years away, and that star being closer allows us to see the disk in really fine detail, so we can get a great analysis of the chemical composition. We can look for planets forming in the disk. And
when you say see, we're not really seeing, though, right?
Not usually. I mean, you can't point your average backyard telescope and see the disk around the star. You need to use infrared or radio or polarized optical light.
And what did you learn?
Well, we learned that there are planets forming in this disk. We see essentially gaps where planets seem to be carving out, either gathering material or gravitationally pushing it away. And we have a solar system forming on a similar scale to that of what we have here in our own solar system.
Is it the same stuff that we have here?
It's very similar, yes. Lots of oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, the basic molecules that we have here.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Let's blast through a couple of emails before we get back to the phones. Well, here's the question. This is from Greg in Albany. Do you think there's life in our solar system besides our own?
Well, I'll jump in and say that one. I am always pro-alien, as in I think there's got to be something out there. Now, I don't know that there's, you know, little green men walking on Mars. I definitely wouldn't go that far. But I feel like with all the life and the different kinds of life we have on Earth, it has to be somewhere. And it may not be in our solar system. It may be in another solar system. But I feel like it's got to be there.
Is that a scientific leap?
You know, we haven't officially discovered anything yet, but I think the signs are really pointing towards yes. The more we understand about how life formed on Earth, the more we think that it could easily form on another planet.
Bob?
Particularly if panspermia proves to be the real thing. In other words, life doesn't really start on Earth, or didn't, but at least the precursors of life, amino acids and other things, we already know about amino acids. There's tons of amino acids in the center of the galaxy in Sagittarius. Enough alcohol there for a lot of wild parties, but enough, there's enough structures for life. So maybe it gets delivered in the cracks on what we would call meteors, and if it gets rained down in early solar systems, and so you don't really have to start from scratch. And if that's the case, then it would be all over the place. Not to mention, now that we know of other water, when I was a kid, we weren't sure of, you know, life started apparently in Earth's oceans. So now that we know that places like Europa have vast oceans and Enceladus and Iapetus and also there's water everywhere. So there might be life everywhere.
I mean, is it a real scientific chore to discover life in another solar system at a distance? How do you do it?
Yeah, I definitely think so. You'd have to look for what scientists call biosignatures, basically elevated levels of things like oxygen, carbon dioxide, or methane in the atmosphere, where you're not directly detecting the life on the planet, but you're looking for the materials that they expel. Our atmosphere has higher levels of oxygen and methane because life exists on the planet, and that's what we would search for.
Now, I thought there was some buzz at some point several months ago that they had detected higher methane levels in one of these exoplanets, but I'm not sure how you would prove that this is a byproduct of life.
Right. I mean, that is really the big leap because there's a lot of natural and chemical processes that make that excess methane as well. So I think further analysis and seeing if the levels change over time would really give us clues if it's life or chemical.
There might be one simpler way, too, and that is oxygen. Here on Earth, we believe that we have free oxygen in our atmosphere, and Valerie can correct me if I'm wrong about this, because plants produce it, because almost every element loves to gobble up oxygen. Iron loves to become iron oxide, and silicon likes to become silica. And you shouldn't have extra free oxygen unless it's being produced, and plant life produces it. So when we see the signature of glowing oxygen, ionized, doubly ionized oxygen, it gives off this green glow at 5,007 angstroms or 5,577 angstroms. Valerie now grew up where it's nanometers now. When I went to school, us old timers, it was always angstroms. You just move the decimal point one digit over. It's no big deal.
Okay.
But so I should say, 557.7, the signatures of oxygen. So when we actually see this light spectroscopically, and we can in other places, it's a green light, and it's almost like the go signal, the traffic light green, meaning doesn't this indicate if there's free oxygen that there could well be plants there? So there's
signs. Have we seen
like
that on any exoplanets yet?
Not that I recall off the top of my head. I don't think so, not yet. But we're just getting to the point where our telescopes are sensitive enough to really analyze the atmospheres independent of the nearby stars in the same system.
Okay, one more email here, I think, and then we'll go back to the phones. This one is from Peter, and Peter's subject heading, Moon Landing Deniers. How big of a telescope would you need to be able to see the lunar lander base on the moon?
No, can't do it. Even,
no.
Even Hubble can't see that.
Even Hubble can't?
No.
All right. Our number here is 800-348-2551. And back to the phones we go. Mike in Saratoga. Mike.
Hey, hello, everybody. I hope you have a good day. I had a quick question. I know there are, like, places out west that have, you know, no light pollution and people go there just to view the skies. Is there anything in the Northeast like that where you don't have to do a lot of work, like climb a mountain?
That's a great question. Having just come back from Chile, where we all stood with mouths agape at the Milky Way, you would think, come on now, with telescopes, mountaintop telescopes at our disposal, would you just stand there and look naked eye and really be blown away by the black detail in the Milky Way? Yes. And the Milky Way casts shadows. And are you kidding?
Okay.
This is just amazing. So here in the Northeast, there are places in the Adirondack. One dam. Do you remember what it's called? One of our people on our tour.
Wakely Dam
in the Adirondacks. A member of our tour group said that they go up there and the skies are as dark as anywhere. And I can tell you, in the Catskills, those who know where this is, take Route 28 past Margaretville, make the first turnoff past Margaretville on Route 30.
Right.
And there's a turnoff at the Popocatépetl Reservoir. If you park there, you get skies that are not quite as good as the Atacama Desert, but pretty darn good.
I would assume Vermont has some spectacular spots as well. But, I mean, you're in Saratoga. I would head north, Mike.
Yeah.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. Polly in Kerhonkson. Hi, Polly, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for taking my call. I was watching a documentary Monday evening, and it said that if something was trapped in the accretion disk around a black hole, it would take longer than the age of the universe to actually fall in.
Yeah.
Does that mean that in effect, nothing since the creation of the black hole has actually fallen into the black hole?
Right, right. So things get tricky anytime you get near a black hole. That's where Einstein's relativity, you know, takes control, and it kind of changes your perception of time. So if you are watching something fall into a black hole, what it's going to do is it's going to look redder and redder to your eyes, and it's eventually going to slow down. So you may never actually physically see it fall into the black hole. But from the object's perspective that is falling in, time is a little bit different, and it will actually fall into the black hole. So it really gets at who's watching and where they are and the crazy mathematics that go along with it.
I see. Thank you.
Thanks, Polly.
Yeah, in fact, it could really be said that black holes cannot form in our universe because taking what Valerie said one step further, the time is so warped, totally warped for anyone outside the accretion disk that for the last bit of material to collapse, to actually make it a black hole, it would take infinitely long, and an infinite time has not yet elapsed. So for those who are looking at the black hole or outside the black hole, that is all of us as observers, black holes will never form. And so in a sense, they don't exist in our universe. But as Valerie again said, if you were there itself, be a different story. Then you'd have no trouble maybe rapidly being swallowed in. So it really depends on who's asking.
My head's going to explode again. Now, wait a minute. They can't exist for our perspective because we're outside of them, right?
Right.
But we know they're there. We can't see them, but we see everything around them, and so we can take pictures of all the outside. And so they're there. Then
That's what relativity
means. If they can't be there and they're there, what's up with that?
That's what Einstein meant by relativity. It means, and you have to get used to there being different perspectives. He called it frames, difference reference frames, and each one being as valid as the other, but giving completely different results, and that there are two things that are incompatible. You just have to get used to it. Even in the universe, the visible universe, we're happy with our visible universe, but there is a distance, 13.8 billion light years, at which things recede at the speed of light, and everything from that point on will never be visible. Is not visible to us. So there is another universe, vaster than ours. We know that thanks to that Berkeley study just a few years ago, far vaster than ours, containing material that we will never see or not know anything about. We just have to live with this.
All right. Well, we'll just take a call then. 800-348-2551 is the number. Emily in Shelburne Falls. Emily, you're on.
Good afternoon. This is really fortuitous because I just bought a telescope.
Oh, great.
And I was like, oh, I hope Bob Berman's on soon, and voila.
How about
here you
that?
Are. I'm a little perplexed. I'm not techie at all, and I got a cheapo 360 Vega telescope that has a tripod. But the other night when I tried to use it, I had to hold it because of the positioning of where our property is and looking out. The house got in the way. Anyway, I could not hold it still enough, first of all, to get any focus going. And so I guess I'm wondering if I went up another $100 for this other telescope that's at a store that I got this one at, would that be worth my while, or should I struggle to try to figure this one out that has 20 millimeters of power and 8 for the eyepiece?
8 just means it's a Huygens type eyepiece, and the 20 millimeters is just telling you the focal length right. of the eyepiece. The magnification will be that focal length of the eyepiece divided into the focal length of the telescope. So you have to look at the little car, the little thing that came with the telescope, and try to say Vega, by the way, not Vega. I know it was written V-E-G-A-A, but that's already been corrupted from the original name of it's a falling eagle or vulture, and it was Wega. It was actually pronounced Wega until about a century ago.
But about the telescope.
The telescope, yes, it's better to spend a little bit more. It's a little disconcerting to hear you say you're holding the thing and you're finding the image unsteady. Well, of course, it's not going to be steady if you have to hold it. A tripod, a sturdy tripod is very, very important. Generally speaking, just as a rough guide, you're not going to get anything worthwhile below about, I'd like to see what Valerie says to this, but I'd say $800,000, $1,200 for a minimum telescope with a sturdy enough tripod, a large enough lens or mirror, and the ability to track the stars. You don't need GoTo. You don't need a computer drive. You don't need any of that, but you do need preferably an electric motor that if at least you polar align it, then it'll track Jupiter or Saturn or the moon or whatever you're looking at so that Earth's rotation won't make the thing you're looking at vanish in a minute or less. So there's a lot to know about it. And if you can contact me after the show at home, I'll be glad to give you better
advice. What's your email address, Bob?
Here we go. It's SkymanBob at... Ray, what's the oldest, lamest internet service provider, ISP?
CompuServe? I don't know. Oh, AOL.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Why is it lame? It's not lame.
It's just old. It's
Our
just
legal
old.
Department wants me to let you know it's not lame.
Right. I don't think it's lame. Fine. Okay, so that's it.
Okay, there you go. So SkymanBob at AOL.com, and Emily, good luck with that. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here from Dudley Observatory in Schenectady, and Bob Berman, who you know from these airwaves many, many times before. You guys have a telescope at the Dudley?
We do, yeah. We just built a roll-top roof observatory outside of our main museum building. It has a 14-inch Celestron telescope inside of it.
All right, that's good. Thumbs up, Bob?
Mm-hmm.
Thumbs up.
Now, wasn't the Dudley Observatory over on Fuller Road for a long time?
Yeah. So it's been all over. We've been in existence since 1852.
In Albany, I think.
In Albany yes. for many years. And it wasn't really until the 1960s or 70s that they transitioned out of Albany and found a new home in Schenectady.
Is
recently.
That building, the original building, still here? I was looking at some old pictures of that. It was pretty
cool.
Yeah,
unfortunately not. No, there is a small school where the first building was, and the second building is where Albany Med stands now.
Okay, very good. Our number here is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go over to Roger and Adams. Roger.
All right. The Geographic recently had an article about sending an all-women astronauts to outer space, thinking of Mars. Do you guys have any opinion on all-women astronauts?
Now, why would they say that? Valerie, you're nodding, so you've heard of this.
Yeah, I have heard about it, and as a woman astronomer, I think it's a fantastic idea. I mean, women are just as capable as men in all of these endeavors, and I think it would be really interesting. Most of our history has men exploring outer space and men exploring the moon, and I think a female perspective would be very interesting.
But from a scientific reason, there's no reason that you could think of?
Right. There's no reason to or to not send a woman into space.
Mm, okay.
Well, the article suggested that women being generally smaller take up less energy, use less food, produce less waste. Therefore, they're cheaper and can be maintained better.
Sure.
Also, obviously, if they're going to colonize, they can reproduce a little better than men.
Right.
Now, but what about the radiation hazard?
Arguments along those lines, and bring fertilized, frozen sperm.
I see.
So that you don't need the men as much. There
right.
is a suggestion that the emotional component of astronauts is a little better when you have mixed genders. So that's an argument against it. But they're strongly thinking about it, apparently, and I found it interesting because obviously at least for the first time, astronauts, they were, I think they were all men for a long time.
Yeah, so there's quite a bit that goes into it. And you're right, it's very expensive. It's tens of thousands of dollars per pound that we launch on a rocket ship. So having a smaller person and less supplies is ideal. One of the things scientists are looking at is the radiation hazard, as Bob mentioned. It's a little bit unclear exactly what all the radiation in space is going to do to the reproductive system, and it may not be possible for a woman to have a child, you know, beyond the Earth. So a lot of that work is being done on the International Space Station, and I think we'll see some more results soon.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's take a break here. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here from Dudley Observatory. Bob Berman is here as well. It's Astronomy on the Program. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. 800-348-2551 is our number. Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. A few emails here. This is an interesting one from Tom. Has anything ever been grown in moon soil?
I've never heard of such a thing, and I think if such an experiment were done, it would be it would have gained definitely. We would have heard about it. Also, moon soil is not like the soil on Earth. It doesn't have anything organic in it, and doesn't have anything that would be. There's no water in it, and by no, we mean like no, like zero. It's anhydrous, or the regolith on the moon. And so I think it would be a tough sell to get anything to grow.
I do know that they have attempted to grow things in simulated Martian soil and have been somewhat successful as long as you fertilize it and give it the water that Mars doesn't have.
Okay. This one is from Phil. I graduated as a geologist and have spent my life in that field. So my question, why do, when we find anaerobic and high temperature life here, anything from yeast to black smokes, smokers and the Precambrian weird wonders of the Burgess Shales, some of which used silica rather than carbonates to form their structures, why do astrobiologists seem to think that life must be based upon O2, I guess it says. Carbon-based, I'm sorry, and breathe O2. Why?
Well, I'm not sure that all astrobiologists are only looking for carbon-based life. It's just easiest to look for what you are familiar with. We don't know what a silicon-based life form exactly would look like.
Or they do on Star Trek.
On
I saw it the other day.
That's true.
Changed the tricorder reading, and it was fine. They could figure it out. So there's no way to tell? Is that the point?
Well, it's not that there's no way to tell. It's just that we don't really know how to search for it. We're very familiar with looking for life that relies on water that's made of carbon. We know how to detect that. How do we detect the silicon-based life form? What are their byproducts? Those are open questions.
You know, now we're in Bob's wheelhouse. He wrote a whole book on the living universe.
Yes, go for it.
Tell us about it.
I'm trying to find a way to segue this to the radiation we were just talking about.
We'll go back to
briefly.
That. Just do this, and then we'll go back to the radiation.
Because, when it comes to space, I mean, the one thing this 50th anniversary has brought up are humans in space. Are we going to go back? Are we going to go further? Are we going to go to Mars? Is there other life? And all of it immediately segues to whatever life is about. Shannon Lucid, who is our woman astronaut, U.S. astronaut, who spent the most time in space, more than any other, continues to express concern about radiation. She thinks radiation is going to be the stopper and is the big hazard for the moon or Mars, and is the reason why it's not going to happen. So everybody should be aware of some new studies, if you look it up, and it's called hormesis, radiation hormesis. And what this means is that the existing model, which is the linear non-threshold model, I know it's a mouthful, but the LNT model, this has existed now for decades. And essentially, it says that no radiation is good for you. All radiation is harmful. A little radiation is only a little harmful, but maybe one person in a million will get cancer instead of one person in 10 if the radiation dose were higher. We all know that given enough radiation, it is going to hurt you. It's going to kill you. But what about low levels like the kind that you might get during a two-year Martian stay? how bad is that? And what is really amazing a lot of people is that studies of people who have had low doses, Chernobyl survivors, Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors, and people like in Kerala on that thorium-contaminated beach in South India, who are exposed to ongoing levels of much higher radiation than the rest of us get, but not a dose high enough to cause outright harm, they have found that the cancer rates are lower in these people, not only than expected, but lower than in control groups, leading many to believe that small amounts of radiation are not only not harmful, but actually good for you, that it seals the body. It offers a kind of protection to the body, a genetic repair mechanism that when you're exposed to more radiation or even other carcinogens later on in life, you're actually protected. Now, I can't get into, obviously, the details, but if you look it up, there's a lot of technical articles in major journals about radiation hormesis, and it's making many question the LNT, long-existing model of radiation being bad for you. And if this proves to be true, now, it's too soon to say that it's proven to be true, but if this proves to be true, it's going to change everything because it's going to make our future as humans going into space and maybe colonizing places like Mars go from difficult or maybe impossible to very possible.
Well, you managed to completely avoid the question about life and different forms and leap right to the radiation.
Don't
so
know
anything. You wrote biocentrism, for Pete's sake.
I did, but biocentrism, this is more, I'd say, almost philosophical or metaphysical. The idea there is that nature and consciousness are a single form of life, that there is nothing that's not life.
Okay.
That, in other words, as the quantum people, Werner Heisenberg, all the people from the 1920s on, and Niels Bohr and all the others who found with the double slit experiment and others that the observer actually changes the physical result, that particles like an electron can be a wave or a particle depending upon where you make the observation, and that it very well may be that consciousness, our awareness, is part and parcel of the universe, that there's no part of the universe that's absent consciousness, and that this is all, you know, that old all is one business that we used to believe when we were hippies. Well, you, Valerie, were never a hippie back in the 60s because you weren't here in the 60s, but that all is one, that may actually be true, and that what we're talking about, where is life? Well, it may all be life. There may be nothing that's really not life, a form of life.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. And
aren't
Valerie
you sorry
Rush.
You encouraged me?
You know
to
what?
I
just, let's just take a call. Keith in Rockville, New York. Keith, you're on.
Hi. Originally, we wanted to know about this Dudley Observatory, if it was possible for a layman to come and peer through the telescope there,
yes.
Dr. Valerie.
Yes,
it is possible.
That is exactly what we are there for. So we are not a professional research observatory. We're a small observatory that's open to the public and part of a science museum. So you can come on the weekends and occasional evenings. Just reach out to me, and I'm happy to give you more information.
Oh, terrific. And you guys have a website,
fantastic.
Right?
We do, yes.
What is it?
DudleyObservatory.org.
All right. Well, Keith, thanks a lot for the call. This email was also on the search for life elsewhere, and LZ writes, on the subject of searching for definitive evidence of extraterrestrial life, given our current technologies and tools, in your estimations, what is the timetable for such a discovery, assuming it is there within our century, beyond that? And that's from LZ.
I'm going to be optimistic and say within the next 20 years, we're going to find something.
Via the SETI program?
Well, maybe not SETI, but maybe something more within our solar system. Maybe some evidence for biological life on one of those moons around Jupiter or Saturn, I think.
SETI program's been something of a bust so far, right?
Yeah, I haven't heard much from them.
Yeah, it's been negative, and it's made some scientists negative. I think it was Fred Hoyle himself, the one who promulgated the steady state theory back when it coexisted with the Big Bang theory back in the 50s. And he and others were saying, and Enrico Fermi famously said that if there's life throughout the universe, where are they?
Yeah.
Why haven't we been visited or heard signals? And you know, it's hard to say something about an absence. So far, we have one data point, which is there's life on Earth.
Right.
That's the only data point. So when you have one data point, how many graphs are you able to draw, really, from that? And how reliable is your is the graph line that you're going to draw?
Okay, let's go to Roger in Poughkeepsie. Roger, you're on.
Yes, I have two questions.
All right.
My first one is, why is the flag waving on the moon when there's no wind?
It's not waving. It's just been made to wrinkle and hold in place to look like a waving flag. It was,
you know, I was thinking about
there.
This today. Did they unfurl it? It was some sort of a semi-rigid material, right?
Yeah. Semi-rigid material that was made to look like a flag that was waving, of course. Unless you think that the whole thing was faked and NASA was so stupid that they'd actually think that people...
No, Roger doesn't think that.
Okay.
All right.
No, I don't think that. My other question is, what is it with this face on Mars? What is the significance of that face on Mars that looks humanoid?
All right, Valerie, this is all yours.
Yeah, so there have been a lot of images that have come back from Mars, and most of the time, and I think you're thinking about the face from the 1970s, a satellite image, it was basically just an old low-resolution image where shadows were cast in such a way that it does definitely look like a face on Mars. But with modern technology and better cameras, we can get a better view, and it really is just a mountain where at certain times the sun does cast convenient shadows. And if you look at a blurry image, our brain tries to make patterns out of that, and it shows us what we recognize as a face.
What was interesting is that that same Cydonia region of Mars that had that so-called face, there's a big outcry to send, when we had better orbiters, send them back there, look at this again. And for a long time, NASA actually wouldn't do that because it was so silly. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's tens of thousands of images taken by various orbiters. And if you look at them, you can see one that looks a little like a hen and one that looks like a Snoopy dog. And so they say, oh, we're not going to bother with that. But when they finally did, and sent a much higher resolution thing at that very face, then you could see it. As Valerie said, it completely disappeared, and you could see the rocks, the pock marks, and the face disappeared in different lighting. You know, it's just accidental. Just like here out in the Dakotas, there's a mound that looks like presidents, you know, and it's just a natural formation.
Cut it out.
And, you know, you just take enough pictures of mountains, and you can see all sorts of stuff.
Roger, you want to follow up?
Yeah, I personally think, well, first of all, I know that Mars is an older planet than Earth. And I personally think that there is a significance, you know, I don't believe in Martians, that's not what I'm trying to say, but there are paintings on caves, you know, of spaceships and stuff like that.
Well.
And I just think that we are related somehow to the planet Mars.
You know, it's sort of another show. Very interesting all the same, though, Roger. I do enjoy that sort of thinking, but I think that's a different show. However, there was a meteorite that they found in Antarctica several years ago, and everyone was pretty excited that, okay, this might be the fossilized evidence. And it turns out maybe not.
Yeah, that was ALH84001. It was the most famous Antarctic meteorite found in the Allen Hills region. And it was Dan Golden, who I personally love because his sister was one of my students and told me that he actually read my page in Discover magazine. So that made me always want to follow him from that point on. And he's the one who had a group of people and actually got on TV and said, "We think we have found evidence for life on Mars."
I remember that.
Now, it turned out they were wrong, but he had the guts to at least... You know why? Because the fossilized evidence in this meteorite looked a little, if you look closely, which they did, looked like fossilized bacteria. You know how bacteria can look like sausages and things like that? But it turned out it was natural. At least that's what almost everybody who later examined it said. Mm. But... it's possible. I mean, Mars certainly had a wet period. They sent some of their rocks to us. We have a few dozen Martian meteorites in hand that managed to find, like this one, like ALH84001. That's been on Earth for 16,000 years. After flying through space, after being Mars got hit with a bigger meteor impact, and then some debris flew, and obviously only a tiny fraction of that would ever find its way to Earth. But that happens from time to time, and you know, it's possible that we'll someday find that. I don't know why our caller thinks that Mars is older than Earth, though. There's no evidence for that.
Same age?
Yes. Yeah. They all of the planets formed around the same time.
Okay. And so that was 4 point some odd billion?
Yeah. Around 4.5 billion years ago.
Let's go back to the phones. Joanne in Schenectady. Hello, Joanne.
Hi there. I don't have a question. I just wanted to let people know that Schenectady Civic is tomorrow is opening a play, a dramatization of the life of Henrietta Leavitt, who was a Harvard astronomer along with some other women.
All right.
It's called Silent Sky. There's a preview tonight, but it opens for the weekend tomorrow night at 8, and it goes on next weekend as well with a couple of matinees. And people can find out more about it at civicplayers.org. Tickets at the door, and we're air-conditioned.
Well, you might need it tomorrow. Joanne, thank you very much for that. All right, so Valerie, tell us again how people can find out about Dudley Observatory.
Yeah, you can go to dudleyobservatory.org. We've got a calendar up there of all sorts of exciting events. All the information you need is on the website.
And if I want to bring my children and go look through the telescope, which will, by the way, probably never happen because I can't get them to do much of anything, we could come.
Yes, definitely. Our telescope is open occasionally in the evenings as well as on the weekends for solar observing.
That's exciting. And how many people will actually do that?
You know, we usually get around 50 people or so to come when the telescope is open.
That's great.
And now that it's summertime, you know, people are enjoying being outside more than they were this past winter.
And I assume that the number one attraction is to see the rings of Saturn, right?
Oh, people love seeing the rings of Saturn and the moons around Jupiter, too.
Yeah, that's exciting. You know, I had a telescope once and had a hell of a time trying to find any of those things. So maybe someday we'll do that. I don't know. Bob Berman, what's coming up for you?
Well, now is a little downtime. Just got back from that chilly total eclipse, which thank goodness everyone got to see. I just worry about the people, you know, that paid money to get down there. So if they see it, I'm fine. And I just worry about my usual thing, Astronomy Magazine and the
Strange Universe here on the station.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, great having you both here. We appreciate it. Support comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, European styling, and prescription and non-prescription sunglasses. Eye exams by appointment. EYEDENTITY Eyewear, Albany.com. The Wild Center, Tupper Lake, New York, presenting We Are All Related, an art show featuring works from Mohawk artisans from the Akwesasne community. Wildcenter.org for details. And C&H Architects, helping clients throughout New England and New York to create a legacy of sustainable architecture through design and collaboration, designed for the next 100 years. C&HArchitects.com. Once again, thanks to Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman for being here today. Thank you for listening. Great calls, as always. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Dina Salzman. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, well, my gosh, it's Friday already. That makes it a Food Friday. Tomorrow at 2, the team from SoCo Creamery will be here to give us a look inside the tasty world of ice cream. So tune in for that one. Right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.